From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Les Paul turned 80 today. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we celebrate his birthday with a 1992 interview. Paul has spent his life playing music, and when he couldn't get the sound he wanted, he invented what he needed to get that sound. He invented the solid body electric guitar, overdubbing, reverb, and multi-tracking. Also today, power guitar. We feature a 1994 interview with Bob Mould. With his first band, Husker Du, he set the stage for what became known as grunge rock. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Congo, based on the Michael Crichton thriller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House has told the Bosnian government it won't lift the arms embargo on Bosnia. Bosnian Prime Minister Haris Salijic met with Vice President Al Gore today. A White House spokesman says the Bosnian government just wants to start a war. Salijic says the Bosnian government has a right to defend itself against the better-armed Bosnian Serbs. The House of Representatives voted yesterday to lift the embargo against the Bosnian government, but the vote was part of a foreign aid bill that President Clinton says he'll veto. There wasn't enough support when the bill passed to override a possible veto. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says Egypt and Israel have opened a new stage in their relationship. He met today with the leaders of both countries. He says their improved relationship could help Israel with its peace talks with Palestinians and Syria. NPR Sadiq Khalid reports from Cairo.
NPR Secretary Christopher announced here that the stalled Middle East peace process was rejuvenated and making progress. The Secretary of State said there seemed to be a new willingness between Syria and Israel to resolve their differences.
Both parties are working very hard. I think they have a renewed sense of the need to make progress. I think they recognize the need indeed to accelerate. That seems to be what is happening at the present time. There's a new intensity about the negotiations. I don't think it's helpful to try to predict the exact outcomes. It's clear the parties have a sense of the need to pick up the speed.
The state-run media in Syria are already hailing Christopher's impending visit, fueling hopes for a breakthrough in the toughest track of Arab-Israeli negotiations. I'm Sunni Khalid in Cairo.
A Democratic senator thinks he's got the answer to concerns about TV violence, a microchip that blocks objectionable programs. North Dakota Democrat Kent Conrad will try to attach his proposal to a pending telecommunications bill in the Senate. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The proposal would allow parents to program their television sets to block out objectionable or violent shows. It would require manufacturers to equip television sets with the necessary circuitry. In addition, Conrad's amendment would call on the Federal Communications Commission to work with networks, cable operators, and parents to establish a rating system. Conrad says his proposal does not tread on constitutional First Amendment rights.
This is not a requirement on broadcasters. This does not limit content. This does not limit the production of anything anybody wants to produce in this country. This just says parents are empowered to make a choice.
Conrad says his amendment will be an opportunity for members of Congress who've been talking about the rise of television violence to actually do something about it. The amendment will be offered next week in the Senate. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 38 points at 4,420. This is NPR. Will he or won't he? Russian President Boris Yeltsin still isn't saying whether he intends to run in the 1996 presidential election. NPR's Ann Gerrels has more.
In an interview with the daily Izvestia, President Yeltsin said the question is premature, that an early announcement would provoke confusion in the country. Imagine, he said, that I announced today my intention to participate in the presidential elections. Straight away, all my decisions, actions, and remarks would be seen as virtually the start of a campaign. However, Yeltsin said declaring I will not stand would upset the work of the presidential staff, government, and many state organs. But the 64-year-old president reassured doubters that both parliamentary and presidential elections would be held as scheduled in December and then in June. Though Yeltsin isn't ready to announce his campaign, others are already warming up for the race, including a bloc blessed by the president, headed by his prime minister, and called Russia is our home. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
The government says inflation at the wholesale level didn't change in May. The Labor Department says it held steady for the second time in 3 months. The government says both food and energy prices fell, but other prices rose a bit. The core rate of inflation, which measures inflationary pressures without volatile food and energy prices, rose 0.3%. Evangelist Billy Graham has been released from a Toronto hospital. Doctors say he is fit to return to the pulpit. He underwent multiple blood transfusions for a bleeding colon. Graham is in Toronto for a crusade which goes through the weekend and says he intends to preach in it. Mickey Mantle's doctors say the baseball great returned to surgery overnight in Dallas. Physicians at Baylor University Medical Center returned to the operating room to correct a problem caused by some post-operative bleeding. Baylor Medical Center spokesmen say this procedure took just half an hour and went smoothly. The bleeding also is not uncommon. It's more common, they say, with patients like Mantle who were extremely ill before the transplant surgery. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
It's the Les Paul Show.
Hi. Hello, folks. Let's see, I've got my guitar, I got my wife, Mary.
Hi.
And I got a room just loaded with electronics. We've got some inventions here that make one voice sound like many voices and one guitar like many guitars. And by means of these 6L6s and plugging them into this amplifier, why, we managed to...
Well, why don't you grab a guitar and show the people what you can do?
All right, I got a lot of ideas. Here we go. Now, that's one guitar. Now, if you want two, I just throw a switch.
How about three?
Easy. Now, if you want four, switch.
Today is Les Paul's 80th birthday. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we celebrate by featuring our 1992 interview with him. Les Paul has spent his life playing guitar, inventing guitars to play, and inventing devices to record himself on. He's invented so much, he's often been called the Thomas Edison of music. For starters, he invented the solid-body electric guitar, overdubbing, reverb, and multi-tracking, inventions that helped make rock and roll possible. But Paul himself has stuck to jazz and a more middle-of-the-road pop. In the 1950s, he had several hits with his wife Mary Ford, including How High the Moon, Vaya con Dios, and Bye Bye Blues. His Capitol recordings, several of his old radio shows from the late 40s and early 50s, and some of his commercial jingles are collected on a 4-CD box set called Les Paul, The Legend and the Legacy. To hear the delightful jazz he's playing today, you need to go to the Manhattan Club Fat Tuesdays, where he's performed Monday nights for over 10 years. Les Paul lives in New Jersey in a home with 4 recording studios. He used one of them to talk with us about his life. We began with his 1948 recording of Lover, which he made in his garage studio. He says it was the first recording that combined all his inventions and recording techniques into one bag of tricks. Les Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. So is that you playing all the parts?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Was this the first record that you overdubbed on?
Oh, no. No, I started it in 1933. I started in the 20s by punching holes in my mother's piano rolls. But I did it because the rhythm guitar player and bass player would go home and I'd say, darn it, I wanted to have him play Limehouse Blues, and I wanted to try something. And I'd say, well, as long as they're not here, what I'll do is I'll play the bass and I'll play the guitar and I'll do that. But I never recognized that that could be such a tremendous tool.
What was different on this recording of Lover from anything that you'd ever done before?
Well, the sped-up sound, the echo, the playing the bass line, making a guitar sound like a bass. This is the first time in history that anybody had ever done anything like that. And then to speed the guitar up and slow the guitar down, and you get all these different sounds by muffling your strings with your wrist. And these were all new things to be exposed to the world. And of course, I had my problems because so many people weren't ready to accept it.
So on Lover, the high, fast, trebly sounds that we hear, that's a sped-up guitar?
Mm-hmm. Along with the normal guitar, mm-hmm. the whole idea there is to be able to get octaves and to go an octave below and an octave above and to do all the harmony parts and everything, you know. And that was not the very first record I ever made that way, but like I say, it was the first. That was the first one to come out. And that came out about a week after I had an automobile accident where for 2 years I was to be in the hospital just in a basket. everything I had was broken, and I was in bad shape for about 2 years. So I had a lot of time to think, and I unfortunately didn't have that many records in the can, so to speak. What I had are records that were completely done except for the last part, which was the melody. And the reason I left that melody off is I figured that every week that went by, I got better. And if I got better, why, I had newer ideas. And so I'd leave that last part off. And after the automobile accident, I had to do the next recordings in a cast, a body cast. And so with one arm fixed right up even with my face in air, the only thing I could move with my right hand was my thumb. So I put a thumb pick on that, laid the guitar. I had a rack built to hold the guitar horizontal, and it laid there flat, and I just stood up and played my part, and that's how I made the parts for the next 4 or 5 records.
This might be the dictionary definition of obsessive.
Boy, I'm telling you, you learn in a hurry to live with the obstacles, and they can be overcome.
Now let me get to one of the hits that you had. Let's talk about How High the Moon, which you recorded with Mary Ford, one of your big hits.
Thank you.
Let's hear some of it.
Somewhere there's music, I'll paint the tune. Somewhere there's heaven, how high the moon. There is no moon above, love is far away too. Till it comes true that you love me inside of you. Where there's music, how near, how far. Where there's heaven, it's where you are. The darkest night would shine if you would come to me soon. Until you will still my heart, how high the moon.
How would you record Mary's voice to get that echo?
Well, that was something that I spent 2 years trying to find out. I didn't want reverb like an empty room. I didn't want Carnegie Hall. I didn't want that sound. I said to my friend, very dear friend, he and his girlfriend, Mary was my girlfriend, and myself, and a fellow named Wally Jones, we were all sitting in a little tavern at Santa Monica and Western out in Hollywood. And Lloyd was arm wrestling with me, and we had a pitcher of beer and some popcorn, and we're watching the fights on Friday night. And, he pulled my arm down really easy, and he says, Les, you're not concentrating. You're usually pretty rough to bring that arm down on. And I said, well, I'm thinking of that echo. And I said, I haven't figured that delay out yet. I haven't figured it out. And he says, well, you still worried about that thing? And I says, yeah, I need it. I need it, and I don't know how to get it. And he says, well, explain it to me again. And so this night, Lloyd, I explain it to Lloyd again. And I says, picture that you're on the Alps. And I say, hello, 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 hello. And I said, I want it to repeat, and I want it to repeat, and I want the delay and the decay to, I want to be able to vary it. And lo and behold, he says to me, you mean like putting the playback head behind the record head? Oh, boy, I threw $10 down on the table, and I said to Wally, pay the bill and bring the girls, you know. And we left him with the $10 bill and the girls, and the beer and the popcorn and the TV were gone. And by the time they got home, you could hear all over the neighborhood, hello, 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 you know? And we'd found the echo, the delay.
You know what I want to know? Why did you want to have echo on her voice?
That's interesting, because I felt as though when you play the note dry, just dead, it just drops like a rock, and it ends right there. And a lot of times you'd like to have that note hang on after you've left it and go to the next note. And it's very similar to ambience in a room, the sound of a room where it's enhanced by bare walls. If I happen to be talking to you and I happen to be in a very empty room, you could recognize that riding in your car, listening at home. You say, well, I can tell that these people are talking in a very empty room. Or you can say they're talking in a phone booth. It's so small. Or it's a very large hall. So you have command over what you wish to do. And in this case, I didn't want that note to say, hey, and just go on like Carnegie Hall. I wanted to go, hey, hey. See? And now, if you want, you put a little tail on it. You go, hey, 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 hey. You know? And it, you know, it gives you such command of so many things, the toys to work with. Today, they're not. I call them toys because the kids, they have all these little boxes that you can go in and buy in the store. When I was a kid and I visualized this thing, the reason I had to invent it is because you couldn't buy it in a store. So if I wanted it, I had to make one.
You know, if I didn't know that you were telling me the truth, I would think that you were really crazy and exaggerated a lot.
No.
You've done so many remarkable things in one life.
Yeah. Yeah, that I have. I wonder why that is. I woke up today thinking about it because in an interview they asked me what I wanted on my tombstone. And I thought about it a minute and I said, I guess I'd put on there, why me?
Do you feel like you were chosen?
I don't know. I just say, you know, I just happened to be around at that time and there wasn't an electric guitar, so I built one. And there wasn't an echo, so I made one. There wasn't a multi-track machine, so I built one. There wasn't sound on sound, so I made one. And it went on and on and on and continues today.
We're featuring a 1992 interview with Les Ball. Today is his 80th birthday. More of the interview after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back to our 1992 interview with guitarist and inventor Les Paul. I saw you about a year ago at Fat Tuesdays, a club in New York where you play every Mondays.
Mm-hmm.
Every Monday, and you sounded terrific.
Thank you.
I understand that you have arthritis of the fingers. How do you play?
Well, after my heart surgery in 1980, they just said, well, you're going to have to do something else because you can't play. Your hands are gone. And I only had a couple of fingers on each hand then. Now I have no fingers in the right hand that move. They're fixed. And so there's no movement except at the knuckles. And in the left hand, I only have two fingers, really one and a half, because the first finger is half frozen and painful. What do I do? I just have figured out that if I could do that, whatever I did then, I just figure out how to do that with two fingers. And so what I have done is, I says, well, what I used to do with two hands and all my fingers, I'm sure it can be done. And lo and behold, it can be.
So you've really taken the same approach to your body as you've taken to designing instruments and engineering equipment.
Oh, are you're great. You're great. Terry, you're great. The key to that is that the same will, the same power that you have to destroy yourself, you can use to make yourself well. If you have arthritis, you just have to have an iron jaw, and you got to go in there and not use any cop out that, well, I can't play anymore because of the arthritis. You just say, there's a way. And I think that determination, I think that, and of course you have to have a lot of luck, and you have to have the right genes and all that jazz to go with it. But I think the bottom line is that if you want to hard enough, you can do it.
What's your threshold for pain? How good are you with pain?
Oh boy, I tolerate pain. It's unbelievable what you can tolerate. If you have that, again, if you have that attitude about it, first of all, you got to think up and not down. And first of all, you don't think of work as a dirty word. You think of that as something that is a privilege. When I was in the hospital and the doctor called me in the office and he says, promise me you'll work hard. And I says, Doc, I thought that's what put me in here. And he says, no, Les. He says, nobody died of overwork. Promise me that you'll work hard. So I went upstairs, and they wheeled me upstairs, and I asked the nurse for a piece of paper, and I drew a line down the center of it, and I put plus on one side, minus on the other. This one, that one, all the great things that we've done in my lifetime. And when it came to the end, I looked at the list, and it was overwhelming that the best time I had in my life was playing in a little nightclub. Now, I'd given up the guitar in 1965 and says, let the young kids have it. I've made my money. I'm going to get out and invent and go manage and record and go another direction, but forget the guitar. This piece of paper in 1980 said to me I should go back and play the guitar, and where I was happiest is in a little club, an intimate nightclub. So when I got well, I marched into New York, and I looked at all the clubs, and finally I find this club. And I said, this is my club. So I go to the manager, and he's 6'4". He's a big, tall guy, Scott. And I says, sir, I'd like to talk to you. My name is Les Paul. He says, Les who? I says, Les Paul.
No.
Yeah. Les Paul. And he says, name sounds familiar. I says, yeah, I play the guitar, and I'd like to come in and play in your club. And he says, well, what do you do? What kind of music you play? And I says, you know, darn if I know. I've never been able to put a handle on that one. And he says, well, what have you got? And I says, well, I got a trio, and I'd like to come in here. And he says, well, I don't think we're interested. And I says, not only that, I'd like to be in on a Monday night. He says, we're not even open on Mondays. And he says, no. And I says, but I'm willing to work for nothing. He says, we're interested.
Right.
And so the bottom line was is that I made a deal with the boss, and he says, I'll put you in for 2 weeks, and I'll take the door and part of the liquor and whatever. Went in there for 2 weeks, and the audience reaction was tremendous, and it was loaded, and you couldn't get in, and it was just great.
Are you still inventing, or are you still in the process of creating things?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What are you working on?
We're working on all kinds of things. I've invented a thing for piano. I got another thing for high blood pressure. I got all kinds of things.
Something for high blood pressure?
Mm-hmm.
You getting into the medical field now?
Well, it's just that...
you need it.
Not that I need it. I saw that there was room for it in the medical world. There's a lot of things that you recognize if you're lying in bed and you see a guy do something that's the hard way. And you say, you know, how come you're doing it that way? Well, the same thing applies to... it goes all the way back to, Terry, if I can really take you way back, it's the first time that my mother in her home had a radio, a Victrola, okay? That's the gramophone, that's the phonograph, okay? And a player piano. And I'm sitting there with all these things. And I looked at it and I says, you know, there's something interesting here. This piano... I can punch a hole in it wherever I wish, and that note will come out. And I can slow it down and speed up, and it doesn't change pitch. Okay? It just gets slower or faster. If I put my hand on a phonograph record and I slow it down, the pitch changes. Why? And that's the key to the whole thing, that curiosity. Of that, you just asked that question, why? And you got your life cut out for you.
Well, Les Paul, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Les Paul recorded in 1992. Today is his 80th birthday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Shining, no more pining, just reach you, smiling through. Don't sigh, don't cry, bye-bye blues.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, what's the physical sensation of playing power guitar in concert? We ask Bob Mould, formerly of the band Husker Du, now leader of the band Sugar. He's one of the most influential guitarists in alternative rock. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new thriller Congo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. 24 Eastern European countries have backed plans for a rapid reaction force in Bosnia. The countries told NATO today they'd go along with the plans. Poland has offered troops and logistical support. Britain and France are putting the force together that is supposed to keep Bosnian Serbs from harassing peacekeepers. NATO says Russia has given the force a lukewarm appeal. One official says NATO's, or rather Moscow's, afraid that the force may not be neutral and trigger more fighting. National Transportation Safety Board officials are investigating what caused the fire on a ValueJet plane last night in Atlanta. From Peach State Public Radio, Susanna Capilluto reports.
Seven people were injured when the DC-9 caught fire at Hartsfield International Airport yesterday evening. The fire started when the plane was rolling down the runway. It burned a large hole in the roof of the fuselage near the front of the aircraft. All 55 passengers and five crew members were evacuated. Only one flight attendant is still in the hospital with second and third degree burns. This morning, ValueJet officials met with members of the National Transportation Safety Board. Later this afternoon, they will hold a news conference to discuss their findings. For National Public Radio, I'm Susanna Capilluto in Atlanta.
Doctors in Dallas report liver transplant patient Mickey Mantle is doing well despite a brief second surgery overnight. Surgeons corrected minor internal bleeding. Bill Zeeble of member station KERA reports.
Mantle's transplant surgeon, Dr. Robert Goldstein, says postoperative bleeding sometimes stops on its own, but bleeding from a broken blood clot was, as he said, too oozy, so he applied a single stitch that fixed the problem. It occurs in about 5% of transplant patients.
These things happen, and the more prominent someone is, the more likely something is going to happen, and that's the way it goes. You know, what can you say? You know, you end up, you do 40 or 50 transplants and nobody goes back, and then the one guy everybody wants to know about has to go back for something small.
Goldstein says Mantle's awake and aware and was able to watch himself on TV this morning. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
A federal bankruptcy judge has rejected another request by Dow Corning Corporation to stop breast implant lawsuits against its parent companies, but the judge did say the request could be made again later. Dow Corning, once the largest maker of breast implants, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection last month. That froze all debts and lawsuits against it while it came up with a financial reorganization plan. Dow Corning also wanted a freeze on all pending and new implant suits, but the judge disagreed. Thousands of women alleged the implants caused health problems, including immune system damage. Dow Corning maintains the implants are not the source of the problems. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower. The Dow lost more than 34 points to end the day at 4,423. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Russian officials have lowered the death toll in the Sakhalin Island earthquake. Authorities now say 1,841 bodies have been recovered. An undetermined number of others died after being taken to the hospital. A spokesman for Russia's Ministry for Emergency Situations said yesterday the toll was above 2,100. No explanation has been given for the revised lower figure. Meanwhile, a ministry spokesman says rescue workers have cleared up all the rubble in Neftogorsk. The town was leveled by the massive earthquake on May 28th. Japan's parliament has approved a controversial resolution of apology to Asian nations for its wartime aggression. The approval came after strong debate that kept the government preoccupied for weeks. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The ruling coalition agreed earlier this week to a resolution that expresses Japan's remorse for its past subjugation of Asia. But critics called it a triumph of ambiguity that dilutes Japan's responsibility. Nonetheless, the coalition rammed the statement through parliament today. The main opposition party, Shinshinto, boycotted the session. Shinshinto was badly split over the issue, but many in its ranks wanted a more clear-cut apology. The opposition has also been waiting for the chance to bring a vote of no confidence against the fragile government of Prime Minister Tomichi Moriyama, and within an hour of the vote was threatening to do just that. So what the coalition had hoped would be the centerpiece of the 50th anniversary war commemorations has turned into a political Donnybrook. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Israel's prime minister says his country and the Palestinians have, quote, passed the point of no return in reaching peace. Premier Yitzhak Rabin spoke today after meeting with Secretary of State Warren Christopher and Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Cairo. The talks also focused on pushing Israel's peace talks forward with Syria and the Palestinians. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bob Mould is a hero to many rock bands and rock listeners. He's one of the most influential musicians in alternative rock. With his first band, Husker Du, he created a loud, fast, and furious guitar sound. It set the stage for what later became known as grunge rock. Mould is also a songwriter and singer. His career has progressed through several distinct stages. He co-founded Husker Du when he was 17. The band broke up 9 years later in 1988. After that, he retreated to a cabin in the Minnesota woods, writing more reflective songs and launching a solo career. His guitar playing, singing, and songwriting are now showcased with his band Sugar. The band has a new CD scheduled for release next month on Rykodisc. Our interview was recorded last year after the release of a Sugar CD ironically titled File Under Easy Listening. We opened with a track from it. Bob Mould, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, Terry.
Let me start with what I'm sure will strike you and also many of our listeners. It's a really stupid question, but I'll ask it anyways. Why would a singer and songwriter like you want to bury their voice so far behind the guitar in the mix?
Well, I mean, sometimes when I'm at home constructing a song, and, you know, especially I think with the more distorted guitar type songs, oftentimes I hear the voice as just something that complements the instrumental track. I don't hear it as a featured instrument per se. With a song like Gift that we just heard, where there's a lot of conflict involved, where everything seems to be fighting for a common space or for to stand out in front for a brief moment. I mean, that's really just the way I hear things in my head. It's not an intentional sabotage of the vocals or anything.
Was it ever challenging for you to find a way to combine songwriting with that kind of, you know, wall of guitar sound that you have?
Well, I think a lot of the songwriting process, you know, made itself apparent through the wall of guitar. When, you know, in a studio setting where I'm layering a lot of different electric guitars, you tend to pick up different, you know, just different order harmonics, you know, second and third order harmonics that suggest, you know, different high voices that you may not think about, and sometimes that affects your melodic sensibility towards a song. Lyrically, that's a separate thing, but you know, that's one way that things get constructed, is, you know, sort of by accident.
What's the feeling on stage of playing that kind of power guitar physically?
It makes your back hurt really bad.
Why does it make your back hurt?
Just the sheer amount of air that's being moved up there. I mean, at my microphone position, the guitar is usually about 125 decibels, and it's a lot to compete with. I mean, physically, it shakes your body really hard up there, and it's almost like you're fighting against that. Like you're fighting to keep your equilibrium, and it's an interesting experience up there sometimes.
Does that physical feeling feel different to you now at the age of 33 than it felt when you were a teenager?
Absolutely. it's not quite as pleasant a feeling anymore. But it has taken its toll a little bit. I mean, I've been out there for about 15 years doing this, and it's a lot. It gets to be a lot more work every time out. You know, I'm really starting to you know, just think of other ways beyond, you know, beyond sugar and beyond the very loud electric presentation, you know, to bring music to people.
Well, why don't I play something pretty acoustic from, this is actually from a Husker Du album, Too Far Down.
Okay.
You want to say something about the song and the performance?
Maybe the darkest song I think I've ever written. that should sum it up pretty quickly. It's a dark one.
About terrible depression?
Yeah, I guess the everyday depression.
Was it that bad?
some months it is, yeah. But no, it's a pretty striking song to me. It's one of my favorites.
Okay, well, this is Too Far Down.
If it was so easy to be happy, why am I so down? Well, all I can do is sit and wonder if it's going to end, or if I should just go. That I just could die, or let someone else be happy by setting my own self free. And you don't want the emotion, 'cause the taste it leaves is for real, but nothing's ever real until it's gone.
When you played songs like Too Far Down that, you know, don't have that power guitar sound, do your audiences ever resist it? You've said that audiences usually want it louder, faster.
Mm-hmm. Anytime I pull out Too Far Down, it can usually silence the entire room. So it has as strong an impact as just a completely different one.
Good.
As opposed to the physical brute force.
What impact does it have on you to know that a lot of people in the audience want you to play louder, faster?
I have to follow my instinct. I mean, hopefully they will appreciate whatever context I present the music in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, when I'm up there, whether it's with Sugar or by myself, I mean, I'm in my own world. I can feel energy coming back. I can, you know, and you know, there's some interaction that's very unspoken and uncliched that happens between the audience and performer, but I mean, you have to follow your instincts up there. I mean, it's not about pleasing the crowd because of what they want, but pleasing the crowd because you're happy with your own performance, and they can sense that.
My guest is guitarist, singer, and songwriter Bob Mould. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Bob Mould, formerly of the band Husker Du, now leader of the band Sugar. Were you in bands before Husker Du?
I was in a band in the fourth grade. I used to have a little pretend studio at home, but it really wasn't a pretend studio. It was like a reel-to-reel machine that I would record, you know, a lot of songs on. And you know, damned if those things are gone forever. But it was really really ironic when I got back into making records with Husker Du that my mom had sent out this little recording studio sign that I'd made with one of those dino guns that I had up on my bedroom door. So sort of everything has come full circle. It's very weird.
Would you tell us a story of how Husker Du formed?
I moved out to St. Paul, Minnesota in fall of 78 to go to school at McAllister College. And this
was your big break from the hometown.
Yeah, getting out of there, I was 17 and had been accepted to school actually my sophomore year. I kept taking my SATs all through high school just as, you know, early as I can remember, just trying to get out. And got accepted early on some kind of underprivileged program, I guess. My parents didn't have a whole lot of money and still don't. But so once I got out there, it was like, okay, now there's a big world in front of me and I can do some things. And just met up with Grant Hart and Greg Norton, the other two people that were in Husker Du. You know, they both worked at record stores. We all had, you know, mutual tastes in music and thought it would be wise to put a band together. Just very simple, usually the way most bands get together, I suppose, at the record store.
No, what did you think of Husker Du as doing that was different from what other bands were doing at the time?
We hated most everything that was going on in Minneapolis, Minnesota, or St. Paul, which was our home base at the time. I think not unlike a lot of non-media center cities in America in the late 70s, you would probably get to a period like 1980 and they'd just be finding out about punk rock and you'd have bands, you know, playing on New Wave Monday or something, you know, and wearing ripped up shirts and safety pins and doing Sex Pistols covers, and then the same band would probably show up on Friday at a suburban bowling alley doing Ted Nugent covers. And I think we just hated all that, and we really, you know, sort of set out to destroy that by playing as fast as we could, as loud as we could, being as aggressive as we could, as belligerent as we could be. And it certainly made people sit up and take notice.
What were the typical highs and lows in the early days of the band for you?
If we got paid for a show, that was a real high point. A low point would be if the cops showed up, I guess, in real simple terms. I mean, in the developmental stage, if I think any kind of project or statement like that, it's really hard to say, oh, what an amazing show, or oh, what a lousy show. I think you're just running on fumes, you know. And the good things are getting paid, the bad things are getting busted.
What would you get busted for?
Setting up in a public space and playing.
Outside?
Outside, or like in the basement of a dormitory or something, and then having like the campus police, you know, come and kill the power or things. You know, I remember Husker Du putting on a little impromptu show in the laundry room of a dormitory I was living in, and it happened to be connected to the basement of another dorm where there was some kind of disco party. And essentially a full scale, you know, like 100-person fist fight broke out. And that was sort of an unnerving night. The only good thing was that was the night that I met Dave Perner and Danny Murphy from Soul Asylum.
Mm-hmm.
As they were going to Marshall University High School, I think, at the time, in Minneapolis.
I know there was a period during the 80s when you were doing speed. And I'm wondering if that helped with your music. I mean, if that put you more physically on the level that your music was.
I'm sure it had an effect on the music. I would guess, you know, very early on, maybe the first two or three records, it had a very pronounced effect. You sort of have to phase yourself down out of those kinds of things. That's something you can do when you're young, if you choose to. But you can't sustain that kind of abuse on your body on, you know, whether it's alcohol or, you know, any powdered drug or whatever. It's great when you're young. I think the music, at least for me, the compositional aspect of it changed when I got all that stuff. I think especially when I got alcohol out of my life in 86, you tend to really start to see the dark side of your work at that point. Because, you know, drugs and alcohol ultimately, you know, they're feel-good things. You know, they're not inspirational devices. They never were to me. It was a feel-good thing. And once you take that good feeling away and you have to look in the mirror at yourself clearly, then you really start to see what's been going on. And that's when you start to pick up all the debris, all the years and years of things that start to come back to you when you least expect it.
Well, I guess looking at the bright side, at least you were able to put that in your music.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot to contend with, and it took me a few years to figure out that that's what was happening. I think when I figured it out was probably in the middle of '88 during the writing for the workbook record,
mm-hmm.
the first solo record. I mean, a lot of things started coming at me that I had never had to think about before.
Like what?
Just, you know, the prospect of having to be an adult, the prospect of, you know, bridges you've burned, relationships that you've damaged, just, you know, the peril of youth.
What was 88 a turning point that made you realize you had to become an adult?
Well, it was after a couple of years of being completely sober. It was after the breakup of Husker Du. It was after, you know, suicides and other drug things running out of control around me, and, you know, watching 9 years of your life disintegrate and having to start over. I mean, as a fixed price menu is a big plate to deal with in front of you.
Was it alarming when Husker Du broke up? I mean, alarming in the sense that you maybe couldn't see ahead what was coming next?
Yes and no. Frightening to not have the safety net, but so exciting to fall a couple times on your own.
Bob Mould recorded last year. His band Sugar has a new CD that will be released next month on Ryko Disc. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have from Bosnia?
Well, we'll be talking today on the program with Haris Salajic. He's the Prime Minister of Bosnia. Noah Adams and Tom Jelton will interview him about his view of what's happening in Bosnia and also the Bosnian government's view of U.S. policy in the region. Also on today's program, we'll hear about the Justice Department's interest in possible antitrust problems with Microsoft's Microsoft Network, its new online service that they're including in their newest software. We'll be hearing about the Cuban government's detention of Robert Vesco, the fugitive from justice. And Pete Breslow, our own Peter Breslow, reports about the truth on Cuban cigars.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Producer Kathleen Kennedy and her husband, the producer-director Frank Marshall, made their names by helping Steven Spielberg make his movies. Kennedy ran Spielberg's company Amblin and produced such films as Jurassic Park, E.T., and Hook. Marshall started directing in 1990 with Arachnophobia and then went on to make Alive in 1993. Now Kennedy and Marshall have a new company for which Marshall has just directed a new movie adapted from a Michael Crichton novel. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Congo.
Michael Crichton has never been thought of as a reactionary philosopher, but his novels do have a consistent message, that if you're the sort of touchy-feely, left-of-center type who thinks that differences among natural enemies can be repaired and that we can all learn to live together with nature in a happy, healthy world, well, be afraid. Be very afraid. To Crichton, if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile, no matter who they happen to be. His book Rising Sun says that while we're trying to talk things over with the Japanese, they're plotting our downfall. Disclosure says that as men finally give women a place in the corporate hierarchy, the women are plotting the men's downfall. And books like The Andromeda Strain, Jurassic Park, and Congo all say that if you try to apply sweet reason to Mother Nature, Mother Nature will fight back with a fury you never imagined. Congo is the weakest of Crichton's stories, and it's the weakest of all the Crichton movies as well. As in Jurassic Park, an ill-assorted crew is descending into the jungle for an encounter with the unknown. In this case, there's an American primatologist, played by Dylan Walsh, who wants to return his brainy gorilla, Amy, to her African home. There's a communications whiz, played by Laura Linney. Her company has found some remarkably pure diamonds in the jungle, and they want to make super lasers out of them, only now the team that found the diamonds has disappeared. Along for the ride is a mysterious Romanian, played by Tim Curry with an even more mysterious accent. He thinks the diamonds come from the long-lost King Solomon's mine, and he tends to get a little carried away talking about them.
First they found the diamonds.
Solomon's men. A diamond mine of incredible bounty. Then they built the city around the mine so that it should be protected. The savagery of the guards was a legend. They instantly fell upon any thief, any transgressor. And the diamonds flowed to the kingdom of Solomon.
Well, what happened? Why did the city die?
I don't know.
Maybe the mines ran dry.
No, no! The diamonds are here!
Anyone who's seen the inept trailer already knows virtually everything that happens in the movie. But suffice it to say that after a long and humdrum journey into the jungle, complete with spooky tribesmen and killer hippos, the movie arrives at a long and humdrum climax. With the exception of Tim Curry, who badly needs reining in, the actors are low on both voltage and charisma, and the more imperiled they are, the harder it is to root for their escape. The film's most likable character is Amy, whom the press kit tries to palm off as a real gorilla, but whose secret identity as a gorilla suit with a tiny gymnast inside is apparent from the moment you first see her. In fact, the special effects in this movie leave a lot to be desired. Fake lava technology especially seems not to have advanced since Journey to the Center of the Earth. It's hard to imagine how Congo could ever have struck anyone as a good idea for a movie, unless, like Kennedy and Marshall, you had watched Jurassic Park strike it rich and figured that anything you pulled out of King Crichton's mine would turn out to be diamonds.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike, research assistants from Becky Cohen. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Farrer, Straus & Giroux, publisher of The Coming Plague, Laurie Garrett's book about the outbreak of infectious diseases from Ebola to AIDS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Clarence Williams III. He stars in the new film Tales from the Hood. Over 20 years ago, he played Lincoln Hayes in The Mod Squad. We'll find out the true story behind Link's afro. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.